Chapter 11.
"Do you see it?" said Heraldin.
"It's a weasel," said Laruna.
"And I'm a bejeweled basilisk. It's a ravenous death machine," said Heraldin. The heroes huddled in a line behind a fallen log, their eyes barely peeking over the mossy bark. Beyond the fallen log, a tiny ball of fur sat in the middle of the road, giving itself a vigorous tongue bath.
"Should we go around it?" said Niln.
"You think we should leave the road?" said Gorm.
The heroes looked. The Mirewood seethed around them. Its black, gnarled trees seemed to block out the sunlight just to spite whatever lived below them. The ground was thick with thorns and creeping nettles, but it still allowed for glimpses of rope-thick centipedes and half-sized arachnids stalking each other through the undergrowth. Weird bulbous fungi poked up through the leaf litter, occasionally rattling as some unknown creature slithered or skittered beneath them. Mysterious pools of muck periodically erupted with thick, greasy bubbles filled with noxious gases.
"Good point," said Niln.
"We could have ridden past it if we still had the horses," said Heraldin.
"Right into the jaws of something bigger and nastier," said Gorm. "The smell of horseflesh brings trouble."
"Somebody just go over there and kill it," said Laruna.
"Sorry, I like my jugular," said Heraldin.
"You'll be fine."
"Have you noticed where we are?" whispered the bard harshly. "Everything here is man-eating, or acid-spitting, or spike-shooting."
"It's smaller than a cat," said Jin.
"So was that explosive fire beetle you sent me after.
And you're fine."
"I barely got behind cover in time. Gaist here thought I was as good as dead."
Gaist nodded.
"Send the goblin," said Heraldin.
"Nob, nob,"
said Gleeback, shaking his head.
"We ain't sending anyone. The bard's right," said Gorm. "If we don't know what it is, we assume it wants to kill us."
"Gods, do we have to stop and hold a high council for every minor distraction we encounter?" said Laruna. "This quest is going to take forever."
"I prefer slow going to a sudden stop, if you catch me drift."
"I could hit it with a subtle spell," Jin suggested. "Oh, no," said Heraldin. "Remember the last time we tried magic?"
"I didn't mean to attract those blood snakes," said Laruna defensively.
"Well, I'm sure the two of you won't mean to call over whatever your next spell attracts either," said Gorm. "No spell casting unless it's absolutely necessary."
"Shh, shush, it's coming this way," said Niln.
The heroes watched breathlessly as the creature ambled toward their log. It wiggled its ratty nose at them, forgot about whatever had brought it in their general direction, and resumed licking itself.
"Anybody have their copy of the Heroes Guild Handbook?" said Gorm.
"I do," said Niln. He pulled the thick volume from his rucksack.
"Look it up," said Gorm.
Niln nodded and started flipping through the tome.
"Look," said Jin, "one throwing dagger to the back of that thing's head, and we're done. It's simple."
"Easy for you to say," said Heraldin. "It's always protect the mages, defend the mages. I've been bitten and stabbed today more times than I care to remember, just so you two can concentrate."
"The right spell can mean the difference between victory and defeat," said Jin. "Protecting the spellcasters is a sound tactical decision."
"I don't see why Keitha can't shoot the bloody thing with an arrow," said Laruna.
"Mirewood. Mire with a Y. Ah, all right. Fauna," muttered Niln.
"Look under Weasel," said Gorm.
"And where is Keitha anyway?"
"Protecting casters is well and good, but I prefer tactics that don't designate me as the meat shield," Heraldin told the mages.
"Why, you're quite suited for it," Jin said.
"Keitha?"
whispered Gorm.
"She said she'd be right back," Niln said absently, flipping through his handbook.
Heraldin shot Jin a glare. "Look, wizard, you may think—" Gaist interrupted the bard by seizing his collar and hauling the man up to look over the log.
"You may—"
"I—" Heraldin's voice fell away as he looked up.
"Bloody bones," swore Gorm. "She split the party?"
"Oh, here it is," said Niln, examining an article next to a picture of the little creature. "It says here that—"
"Oh." Jin looked over the priest's shoulder at the entry.
"Perhaps you were right, Heraldin."
"Perhaps,"
said the bard, craning his neck back.
"Of all the thrice cursed stupid times to run off and split the bloody party," Gorm snorted. "Who knows what trouble she's in?"
"Maybe she thought we could handle a little weasel," said Laruna.
"Burn what she thought," barked Gorm. "We don't know what we're up against."
"We do, unfortunately,"
Niln read from an entry in the handbook.
It says here that the northern Ragnaril, Tyrannus in Cresco, when enraged, will actually
grow to enormous size, said Heraldin, looking higher.
Why, yes, how did you...
Oh. They stood just as the towering Ragnaril roared. Heraldin drew his rapier grimly.
Gods, I hate this place.
Caitha crept through the malignant undergrowth of the Mirewood. Her hair had wound itself into an intricate web of knots and was cemented in place by some unidentifiable muck that one swamp denizen or another had spat on her in the heat of battle. Sweat and swamp grime were having a turf war all over her body. Whichever won, her nose lost. All she needed was a private space, Caitha told herself. She just needed one potion to take the edge off, to make this nightmare of a quest a little more bearable. Getting a hit of elixir would take no more than 5 minutes. The others would hardly notice she was gone before she'd be back. Something roared behind her, back where she'd left the other heroes. For a moment she thought of turning back, but her wrists itched at the thought of not taking a potion. A fast one. She'd be back with the other heroes soon. No more than 10 minutes. She slipped around an ancient and gnarled oak, climbed over a stone wall overgrown with thick vines, and scurried down a gully choked with heavy brambles. There was a sheltered spot in the belly of the gulch, and Caitha settled into it quickly. Her hands trembled as she pulled the healing potion and her hunting knife from her rucksack. Quickly she removed her bracer and rolled up her sleeve. The knife was almost to her wrist when the light caught her eye. It was just a faint glow under the brambles, as though the light wanted to look inconspicuous, lest the huge shadows around it take notice and decide to snuff it out. But it was sunlight, and it carried with it the sweet scent of air unsullied by the Mirewood's foulness. Something else carried on the fresh air as well, a sensation Caitha couldn't identify, but couldn't resist either. She slipped her rucksack back over her shoulder and put her knife to work cutting back the thick brambles. It took several minutes for her to thin the undergrowth enough to push through the briar. Caitha stepped through the thorns. The knife fell from her hands. Her breath caught in her throat. Exquisite arrangements of wild flowers and emerald grasses spread before her. A few yards away, she found a stone path grown over with sugar moss and mint-green lichens. Caitha followed the path up a gentle slope, meandering under white trees that had been coaxed into natural arches. A cool stream of fresh, pure water bubbled alongside her. The branches overhead were sculpted such that brilliant sunlight cascaded into the glade and cast scintillating patterns over everything. Questions flooded her mind as she crossed the garden, treading lightly on brilliant mosses. Where was she? How could such a garden, beautiful enough to rival the greatest of House Tyriath's palatial grounds, be growing in the heart of the Mirewood? Who could conceive of a place like this, let alone grow and maintain it? Was it the work of a man or a god? And if it was a man, was he single? A song she didn't remember sprang to mind, and she couldn't hold it back. It had been decades since she'd lifted her voice, and her first notes wavered uneasily. She found the music soon enough, however, and filled the garden with her song. There is a law to the universe, and among its many precepts is the certainty that when an elven princess sings, small animals will be drawn to the song. Even if the princess was technically disowned centuries ago, and had since become a washed-up hero of somewhat ill repute, and even if the only animals nearby were hardened and battle-scarred from a lifetime of fighting for survival in a death swamp, the law still held true. Ragged chipmunks and venomous snakes alike followed in Caitha's footsteps, swaying with the melody of her song. She gently patted the nose of a savage-looking deer, the kind of grizzled doe that a soft puma from the foothills wouldn't stand a chance against. For a time she walked along the winding path, singing to the animals that flitted and skittered around her. In the inner parts of the garden, a song answered hers, a piping melody she hadn't heard for decades. An Aethanalasi was perched high in the branches, sending its enchanting melody throughout the garden. Caitha's smile widened as the tiny bird's music began to harmonize with her own, and soon she was in a duet with the most sacred of songbirds. She began to dance, gracefully twirling through the trees with an imaginary partner. They danced beneath arches of lilacs, past fruit trees grown into exquisitely flowing shapes. She commented on the flowers as she passed, telling her non-existent companion which blooms caught her fancy, or asking what his favorites were.
As Caitha danced and spoke with her imagined partner, she felt a growing sensation he was actually there. Not in her arms, certainly, but just beyond the edge of her vision, like a spirit of the garden moving along with her. It was like dancing with the memory of a lover, only one that she'd never known. She told him as much, but he remained silent. Before she knew it, she was at the end of the path. Ivy and brilliant blooms spilled over the rocks like a lush, living river. Vibrant bushes and patches of wildflowers sprang from carefully arranged stones. Squarely in front of her, an ancient maple sat like a holy man atop a cluster of moss-covered boulders. The largest, clearest stream of sunlight poured down and bathed the maple and its stone circle in sacred light. Caitha stepped from the path and into the inner sanctum. The garden's winding stream burbled from a spring beneath the stones. As Caitha stole a sip of the cool spring water, she noticed a spot worn free of moss near the base of a large rock. Someone had moved the stone, recently and often. It took a surprising amount of effort to move the stone. Caitha had to brace her back against it and use her legs to rock it from its place. It finally toppled with an explosion of vibrant color. Lavender beads, painted thrones pieces, mussel shells, scraps of velvet, violet figurines and decorations, grape quartz and amethysts, a spectrum of purple trinkets bled from a cleft in the stone. Caitha watched the violet mass spill over the mossy ground and knew whose garden this was.
"Hello," she said. "Are you the king in the wood?"
The garden was silent.
"Are you there?"
As she recalled the innkeeper's tale of the Meyerwood's mysterious monarch, it dawned on Caitha that the king in the wood was known primarily for protecting people from the perils of the swamp she was currently wandering through. It also occurred to her that while the tales depicted the king as some sort of benevolent force, he may react differently to elves who entered his sanctuary and vandalized his stash of brightly colored trinkets.
I'm sorry about this. I really didn't mean to," said Caitha.
She drew the violet star beads she had purchased from the innkeeper and placed them atop the pile of spilled trinkets in a feeble gesture. And now the full weight of her folly was bearing down on her. She didn't know who the king in the wood was, or what he was. The presence in the forest could have been a benevolent protector, but it could just as easily have been some loathsome denizen of the Meyerwood luring her to a horrible doom, like some sort of botanical siren. The shadows were already starting to lengthen, and if she couldn't find the other heroes again before sunset, she'd be spending the night alone in the Meyerwood. Icy fear crept down her spine as she realized how vulnerable she had left herself. The last vestiges of the hero she had been echoed in the silence of her terrified paralysis, and the memories and experiences of the career that was drifting away from her could finally be heard.
"Run, you fool!" said the remnants of the jade wind. "Get back to the party!" "I'm sorry," she said again, and broke into a full sprint down the path.
Dark shapes moved through the trees beyond the edge of the garden. She could hear the screeches and squeals of scargs and swamp beasts and unnamed horrors ringing through the Meyerwood around her. She stopped when she reached the brambles and turned back to take in the sight of the wondrous garden one more time, a vision of paradise in the midst of an infernal swamp. For a moment, she stood torn between the feeling that she could stay forever and the knowledge that she had tarried too long. Something howled in the distance.
"Goodbye,"
she whispered to the garden and pushed back into the brambles. Gorm lodged his axe in the twisted trunk of a tree by the side of the road. Red sap bled from the gouge in the black bark.
"Do you think she'll see that?"
Niln asked him.
"She's a ranger," said Gorm, wrenching the axe free, "and we're leaving a trail so clear that a drunken ogre could track us. If she has any of her senses left, she'll find our trail."
"Of course, if she had any of her senses left, she wouldn't have split the party in the Meyerwood," said Heraldin.
"I'm still not sure why we didn't wait for her," said Niln.
"Because she didn't say to," said Gorm. "She could assume we've gone ahead and overshoot our position, and then how'd she find us? And how long will we sit in the middle of the Meyerwood waiting for her to show up? There's no good option when the party is split."
"I suppose you're right," said Niln.
"All we can do is keep moving and hope for the best," said Gorm.
"And keep marking our path."
Gorm hacked at another tree by the side of the road.
"That too," he said.
Katha saw another slash in the tree just ahead, red sap painting a crimson streak over the trunk. She was getting closer to the party. The sap was still fresh and oozing. The trail couldn't have been much more than an hour old. Then again, an hour was a long time to survive alone. Dark shadows moved through the forest around her. Katha could make out the flowing reptilian shapes of swamp threshers between the trees, running at a swift lope alongside her. She thought to ready her bow and take a stand against them, but a moment later, the great lizards veered away and left the road. The swamp threshers were only the latest threats to suddenly cease pursuing her. Katha had seen boggarts and swamp leeches that had seemed intent on fighting only to flee at the last moment. At one point, a tusked muck beast had actually charged her from the swamp, only to be seized by something even more terrible and yanked back into the undergrowth. Katha didn't wait around to see what could dispatch the creature so effortlessly. She was sprinting down the road again before the creature's death scream was cut short. She had the sense of a presence keeping pace behind her, although she could never see it, and she wasn't sure it was actually in pursuit. It occurred to her that the phantom at her back could have been responsible for frightening off the Meyerwood's other predators, but then it could have done so to claim her as its own prey. There wasn't time to think about it. She ran on, ignoring the fire in her lungs and the ache in her legs. The road turned to the right, and then hooked back to the left, before curving around a festering pool. Then, two men were standing in front of her. Katha skidded to a halt. The men in the middle of the road wore dark leathers and long scarlet cloaks over chainmail. Their swords looked sharp, their smiles looked cruel, and their eyes looked like they saw an opportunity.
"Well, what have we here?" said the first man. "You must be who the others was leaving a trail for, eh?" said the second. "A good possibility," agreed the first man. "There was quite a few of them making that trail. But it looks like there's only one of you, miss."
"Bandits," snarled Katha.
"Whoa, whoa, whoa," said the first man. "What's with the hostility and the labeling?" "Don't be so eager to jump to conclusions," said the second. "Why, for all you know, I could be a druid concerned for the well-being of these precious pretty trees that some uncouth cur has taken an axe to. And I could be a concerned citizen going to check on the well-being of those poor unfortunate travelers."
"Get out of my way,"
Katha panted, hoping it sounded more like a warning than a plea.
I would, said the man, who didn't seem very much like a druid, "but there are economic realities that we have to address." "Most pressingly, we don't have enough money," added the man who was not acting like a concerned citizen. "Or jobs," said the first man. "Or jobs, yes, which is probably a big contributing factor to us not having any money. You, however, have the looks of someone with money. At least valuables that we could sell."
Katha reached for her bow, but the man who probably wasn't a druid raised his hand.
"I wouldn't do that if I was you, miss. Something might happen."
Katha paused. The three of them waited. As the men's patience faded away, so did their confident grins.
"I said something might happen," repeated the man, who almost certainly wasn't a druid. "Like a warning shot could be fired from a crossbow?" added the man, who was definitely not a concerned citizen. "You don't suppose," said not a druid. "He usually stays deeper in the swamp," said not a concerned citizen.
Katha turned to look at the spot the bandits were staring at. A crossed pair of branches provided excellent cover for a crossbowman seeking to cover any highwaymen plying their trade below. There just wasn't a crossbowman in them. Something fell from the branches above and landed on the road with a clank. It was a crossbow.
"He's here," whimpered the man who wasn't a druid, drawing his sword. "The king in the wood," said the man who wasn't a concerned citizen. "What do we do?" "Let's grab her and go," said the man who wasn't a druid.
The bandit stepped toward Katha, although his eyes kept shifting to the dark swamp all around them. In his distraction, he had clearly forgotten he was not dealing with a helpless traveling merchant, but with a well-armed rank 10 ranger. More importantly, he had failed to notice that Katha had drawn her bow while he and his partner were paying attention to the swamp. It only took one shot.
"Get out of my way," Katha repeated, training an arrow on the second bandit.
The man who wasn't a concerned citizen looked at the twitching body of the non-druid, and then at the elf aiming at him, and finally at the swamp. Finding no good options, he chose the path of least visible resistance and fled into the woods. Caitha didn't lower her bow. She turned in circles, trying to find a target. Something out there had silently taken the crossbowman. Indeed, it seemed to be killing or chasing away everything that threatened her. And while her followers' activities had benefited her thus far, that didn't mean it was necessarily on her side. In the Mirewood, the enemy of your enemy might just be very hungry.
"Show yourself," she demanded to the forest.
A short scream, perhaps from a citizen and certainly very concerned, rang out and was suddenly silenced by a sound that made Caitha's stomach turn. She pointed her arrow in the direction of the scream.
"I know you're there,"
she shouted. The swamp quietly simmered all around her.
"Are you friend or foe?"
she asked. A sudden rush came from the bushes to her left. Caitha shifted her aim quickly, but it was only a bog grouse flying from the undergrowth.
"Are you the king in the wood?"
A hush fell over the swamp. Even the insects and scrub birds ceased their quiet chittering. Caitha could feel the presence in the shadows growing near, but though she strained her eyes, she could see nothing in the mirewood but trees and boulders and muck.
"Are you helping me?"
A new scent filled the air, like moss and earth, like the garden she'd left behind. The phantom was so close now it was almost palpable. She could feel its nearness in her bones. She could hear its heartbeat in her own. It didn't feel like an enemy. After all, she reasoned, if it was hostile, why hadn't the phantom struck yet? Surely it had been presented with ample opportunities to end her. For all she knew, her back was to the creature right now. Caitha lowered her bow.
"Was that your garden?"
There was no response. She tried laying her bow on the ground and backing away from it. She sang as she had sung in the garden. She promised it that she was no enemy, pleaded that it accept her thanks, and begged it to come and show itself before she had to leave. But the phantom would not reply nor reveal itself, no matter what she did. It hovered at the edge of her perception, a hint of a companion, a whisper of a protector, and would come no closer. The other heroes were drawing away from Caitha with every passing moment, and there was no telling how long her invisible guardian would watch over her. She couldn't stay where she was, as much as she wanted to meet her savior. She surveyed the wood one last time. She didn't see anything. Perhaps the elixir was starting to get to her. Perhaps there was nothing to see.
"Thank you,"
Caitha said to the phantom, just in case it existed and understood and cared. She retrieved her bow, slung it over her back, and resumed sprinting down the road. For another moment, the forest remained still. Then, something followed her.
"Definitely male," said Jin. "Look at the jawbone."
"I would rather not, thank you,"
Nil managed. The High Scribe was doing his best to assist with the forensic investigation, but he didn't have the stomach for it. He'd been heaving his lunch into a ditch since the heroes had first stumbled across the body in the road, and in the ditch next to the road, and in the trees nearby. Gorm surveyed the carnage. The dossier of intelligence provided by House Tyriath indicated that the bandits who took the elven marbles were somewhere nearby. It was possible that the art thieves were all around them, or at least one of them was. Jin looked up from the collection of bones and scraps of clothing he'd meticulously arranged on the side of the road.
"I'd say we're looking at a human male, mid-50s or older, 6 foot tall, has a physically demanding profession, enjoyed tobacco and the odd spot of rum."
"You can't know all that from a pile of bones," said Laruna.
"Oh, but you can. Note the stained teeth."
The Noctomancer launched into a lengthy explanation of his findings and methodology. Gorm noticed something under the leaf litter. He picked up the smudged slip and examined it.
"Male human, 46 years old, 6'1", weighed 18 stone, professional thug."
"Now how could you possibly know all that?" said Lorena.
"Found his thug's union card." Gorm held it up. "Name's Blenford R. Kerbenfurt, nicknamed Big Blenny."
"Well, that doesn't make any sense," said Jin. "Why would a thug be a bandit?"
"He wouldn't. Thugs can make better money enforcing contracts or wrangling heroes," said Gorm.
"Maybe he was after the bandits?" suggested Niln.
"Maybe," said Gorm. "Maybe this has nothing to do with the marbles."
But he had a sense in his gut that the body and the artwork were connected. He just didn't know how. They needed more information.
"We need to find where he was coming from. And was he alone? And did he find our bandits?"
"Shabs Klago Hapsa!"
Gleebec bounded exuberantly up the road. Relief washed over Gorm, who couldn't hold back his smile.
"What did he say?" Niln asked.
"Still no idea," said Gorm. "But I'm betting they found her."
Gaste and Haraldin were already rounding the bed, supporting Caitha between them.
"Scatimi!"
said Gleebec. The heroes gathered around the ranger and pelted her with questions. Where had she been? Did she encounter any trouble? How did she make it back? Why did she leave at all? Gorm stood back and let them chatter.
"Was she followed?"
he asked Gaste. The weapons master shook his head.
"Good," said Gorm. "All right, that's enough."
The reunion tapered to a couple of whispered conversations. All eyes turned to Gorm.
"I'm as happy to see the ranger as anybody, but we're still in the mire, would I?" said Gorm. "And I, for one, would like not to be here any longer than necessary. So, let's get information, figure out where our friend Big Blenny came from, and find them thrice-cursed marbles before nightfall. There'll be time for talk back at the inn."
He leveled his eyes directly at Caitha, though leveling them was more like an upward incline.
"And we will talk," he said, "at length."
Caitha winced.
"I'm sorry."
"Later," said Gorm. "This ain't the time or place for talking about it."
Too many heroes met their end when a foe caught them settling interpersonal issues instead of scouting a dungeon or posting watch. Adventurers who lost their heads in a figurative sense often lost their heads in a more literal manner shortly thereafter. The heroes formed a huddle around Big Blenny's discarded license.
"Right," said Gorm. "Here's what we know. This man was a licensed thug. He met Mordo Og earlier than he would have liked, and he was probably running from whatever sent him off."
"What makes you sure he was running?"
asked Laruna. "The expression on most of his face was pretty scared," offered Haraldin.
"Most of?" said Caitha.
"Well, I doubt the rest of it is smiling either," said Haraldin. Niln fell back to his knees and heaved up his breakfast. Gorm sent Gleebec to attend to the nauseated high scribe.
"A better clue," he said pointedly, "is that we don't see any traveling gear around. So, either he was waltzing through the Mirewood without a care in the world, or he left his camp in a hurry, which leaves us with two questions. Why was he running, and where was he running from?"
"How can we know that?" said Niln.
Gorm grinned at Caitha.
"Luckily, we happen to have our ranger back."